I'm Haley.
I'm John.
And I'm Will.
And we're from Crimson Comet, a podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network.
Just like the one you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of the individual host.
Check out other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready, because geekiness begins in
3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I am a ray of sunshine.
And Keir Hansen.
Pro-action. Pro-action? Is that a word?
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 114 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we cross paths with our childhood friend, child of the same nature and nurture, now turned psychopathic adversary, and we reflect fondly on all the fun times we've had defeating them over and over and over and over. Joining you in the GPR studios this evening, my name is Keir. To my left, as always, is the eponymous Jay. Jay, good to see you, sir. How are you?
I am doing outstanding. How about yourself?
I'm doing great, actually. It's been a really, really good weekend, even without new material to play with.
Yeah.
But we're doing all right. And over there to my right, rifling through the trash at the moment, is Haley. Haley, get your head out of there and say hello.
What? It's good.
Yes.
Garbage.
Exactly. Another man's treasure, damn it. She's a little punchy after Black Friday, I think.
A little bit, you think?
We have to restore her faith in humanity for an hour here or so.
I don't think there's a lot of hope about that.
Or we're going to drink for about an hour or so.
Yeah.
And well, forget about humanity.
Doing no service to restoring my faith in the humanity. The guys are trying to tweak my OCD a little bit this week by making me watch episodes out of order to get a fuller backstory on the Doctor's infamous nemesis. Unprepared viewers were recently stunned by the Master's murder of a fan favorite, but we learned that this was a necessary evil to solidify the criminal insanity of the character and put justifiable viewer concern behind the centuries-old conflict. We revisit both the televised origin of the Master and some more recent regenerations and see how this character has evolved.
Talk about a there and back again kind of relationship between these two. There's a reason why whenever you've got a title character known by some, you know, nom de guerre, and his counterpart, his or her counterpart, also single name there, you know, you're either going up against Cher, Madonna, the artist, other one named people. Who we got?
Roseanne.
There? Roseanne. Oh, hell. You're doomed, Doctor. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. So we wanted to be kind of very particular about, rather than doing a full walk of all of the permutations, both on screen and extended content about the Master, we figured we'd take a couple of kind of critical points that give us some very important, as Haley said, backstory, but also in effect a kind of the watching the progression of their relationship between Doctor and Master as they both go through regenerations, because we've been talking a lot lately about how the Doctor's regenerations cause very calculated personality shifts, and we figured we'd look and see whether the Master has gone through the same kind of progression, either upward or downward on the scale. So I'm thinking downward. I'll take slow decline for 300, Alex.
So, yeah, we wanted to take a look specifically at when the Master was first introduced, his very first appearance in Terror of the Autons, and kind of look at how the similarities and also, you know, the major differences between then and, you know, the newly reinvented Master that we have now. Right. And just, you know, see the, I mean, we've constantly talked about how the Doctor is, you know, always evolving and always, you know, changing, but always being the same person and everything. But we've never actually, you know, taken that look at the Master.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned Terror of the Autons, and you're putting the entire storyline into the hands, at that point, we're talking around 1970-71, into the hands of Barry Letts and Terrence Dix. They had been sort of saddled with
the responsibility of dealing with a storyline that had been sort of like, just as the Doctor was going through, it was tying the hands of the writers, because you were landlocked, essentially, you know, in terms of taking the Doctor's interstellar or intertemporal travel away. And so you had to come up with something that was going to be a legitimate threat. It was going to be engaging. It was going to be something that, that kept the terror level high for the show and made it, you know, one of those genuine kind of, you know, cling to your, you know, the armrests of your chair sort of moments.
Yeah.
But in a very limited scale. So, or, well, not scale, but a limited facility to do so. So, the creation of this devious Time Lord counterpart, was their means of being able to up the ante on the program without having to do extensive set work and things of that sort.
Right. So, Haley, what did you think about the master and terror of the Autons? What did you think about going back? Because you, your first introduction to the character was with John Sim, right?
Correct. Yeah, I mean, I started with Sim, and then when I first joined GPR, you guys had me watch the Seventh Doctor episodes with, there was a master in there, and then, you know, I saw Selena Gomez. Right. But
Michelle Gomez. Stop it. Well, when you were seeing Seventh Doctor, you were seeing the sort of the knockoff Delgado Anthony Ainley, and not to say anything against Ainley as far as his contributions to it, but in terms of they were really attempting to create the same iteration of the Master, just with another actor.
Yeah,
right. Well, as soon as this guy walked out of his TARDIS horse carriage or whatever, I was like, oh, so this is a villain, because he looks like a Bond villain.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the comparison has been drawn that, you know, the Third Doctor really was our version of James Bond, basically. You know, Bond was just coming out, very popular, and they wanted to do that kind of same thing. So it makes sense that you would go with someone who, you know, could easily, you know, just glue a couple horns on him and paint him red, and he could pass for Satan. You know, it's he does have that evil look, but that's what people expected at the time.
And that was kind of the formula that they followed. And the relationship between the two never really ran too deep, you know, as far as a connection between the two. The kind of backstory now that we think is kind of defining for the characters and the way that they interplay with each other. Other than the fact that we just knew, at least from televised material, that they were both Time Lords, both from Gallifrey. One was, you know, a servant of the light and the other a servant of the darkness, kind of a thing.
Both outlaws.
Yeah, that's really about as far as it went, because it was just a matter of, you know, they even discussed it. It was a matter of, you know, the Master was described through Third and Fourth Doctor appearances as being one who had become so infatuated with the darkness that it consumed him. And that's about as far as it went.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, one thing that really stood out to me watching this was the Master, and with Delgado's performance, was very meticulous. He overlooked things that didn't fit what he wanted to be, but, you know, he did have a plan. It wasn't, you could tell from the very beginning he was following a, you know, a list of, you know, step one, do this, step two, and there was a method to what he was doing. And it was very much, you know, Holmes and Moriarty kind of thing, where, you know, it was two people, you know, the exact same, basically trying to outthink each other.
Right. Battles of intellect throughout. Mm-hmm. But it was more of that classic Holmes Moriarty, more of the literary Holmes Moriarty battles of wits and things of that sort, you know, and mm-hmm. I made sure to point out there's the direct quote that Delgado throws at him that, you know, refers to him as his intellectual equal. Almost. He throws a little caveat in it.
Almost.
But that's just the thing. I mean, he gets so wrapped up in, and they love using the term or using the phrase, because you hear it used in countless episodes where he keeps referring to it as the master plan, because ha 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 ha.
Yeah.
But that's really what it is. He plots these things out. He's got them worked out. Or often we come into it finding out that he's been laying the groundwork for these things for far longer than anyone has recognized. And they continue to do that today.
And
as we see. But as he goes through these things, he gets so wrapped up in the big picture and all of the details and the fact that he has to micromanage all of the steps to see it along, regardless of what other race, species, minions, mind control, lunks, anything that he's using, he misses some critical detail. You know, that one loose thread, the only loose thread in the tapestry, and it's the doctor's job to find that thread and pull on it every single time.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I said, it's normally the thing that the master overlooks because it's the thing that would make his whole plan fall apart. You know, it's, with this one, it was, you know, do you really understand the evil that you're unleashing? You're so hungry for power, but have you thought beyond what will happen, you know, what your stake in this is? And that's what finally gets him, is that, well, I have no way of actually controlling these guys once it, well, crap, you know.
quick, help me pull
my
this lever.
My brilliant master's plan, except for that one tiny detail.
But that's the thing, is he thinks it all out, and there's this one thing that, you know, he just, well, that could be problematic, so I'm going to ignore that. And that is usually the thing that the doctor has to bring up to say, hey, look, everything's going to fall apart because of this.
Right. I will say, though, one of the things you kind of have to bear in mind, that formula that Letts and Dix applied through Third Doctor's tenure, and you do get a lot of appearances, and then by the time you get to Fourth Doctor, you know, some of these go-rounds become, well, quite repetitive, and on throughout, the televised plotting and downfalls, repeated downfalls of the master tend to fit that form. You know, we don't really start getting some real twists as far as televised insight into the master's machinations until Sim, really for the most part. But if you do go into the book material, you do go into the audiobooks, you do go into even some of the comic material that was placed out there, you get some really interesting stuff. Master Plan, you know, subtly named itself, is one that really stands out as far as Big Finish stuff to get a hold of. But there were Dark Path and Menagerie and a couple of the other novels that even go back and have some interaction between Doctor and Master in Second Doctor, where it's really more focused on the intricacies of the Master's escape from Gallifrey right after the Doctor did, on the same day, apparently. But because everything was in such a state of turmoil with the Doctor's theft of a TARDIS, that the Master was able to make his getaway relatively unnoticed. And that sets all the wheels in motion. So if you really want to dive into the full universe of it, they're constantly, like, sort of just crossing paths. Even if they don't encounter one another in a lot of instances, you find that one or the other are dealing with the repercussions of the other's recent departure. And it's a really kind of intricate tapestry that the story builds into. Yeah. A lot of fun to try.
So. And I just picked up Dark Eyes 3, actually, and I'm working my way through that. And, you know, it's another example of the Master and just it's a new take on him, so it's not what you're used to watching the show and kind of and stuff, but it's one of those characters that you really can, like, I mean, you see it a lot in like comic books especially, where, you know, you need a villain that can go toe-to-toe with the hero every time, and the easiest way to do that is say, okay, take the hero, make him evil, and that's your bad guy. Now you look at, you know, I mean, the one that stands out to me the most is Spider-Man and Venom, where it's, you know, almost exactly the same thing. It's just, hey, look, this is the good guy, this is the bad guy, because he wears all black, you know. And aside from that, there's, you know, there's little to no difference. So, and we see this here is where it's like, okay, well, the Doctor is, you know, a Time Lord, check. Insanely brilliant, check. Has a TARDIS, check. Okay, we'll just make the Master kill people. And that's the difference there, you know. And it's one of those things that fits so well that you can write really interesting stories around it because that core is so solid.
Right. I think what happened was, and Haley, I'm going to pick your brain on this one to a certain degree because of the fact that you sort of came into the knowledge of this character technically Sim, but you kind of probably really saw it first when it was Derek Jacobi, you know, as the Yana Master.
Right.
But the idea of now, we were talking about how if Delgado and Ainley and that iteration of the Master and his relationship with the Doctor was kind of the classic literary Sherlock and Moriarty. Now we have something in post 2005 in RTD and beyond, where since the Doctor is a little bit more clever is not the right word. Help me out here. To give his sort of a of his leaf on the wind kind of a kind of behavior compared to our classic doctors. You know, the charming crack hip a joke
and arrogant.
Okay, yeah, I'll go with that. But by the same token, if that's going to be that sort of thing, you need to have your foil be equally unpredictable, sort of just random, you know, but dangerously random as opposed to heroically random,
right?
So is a chaotic evil versus chaotic good, I guess, on the on the grand scale of characters.
Yeah, that works.
So yeah, okay, cool. I could work a little D&D in there.
Well, I'm throwing it back into the comic lore too. If you look at, you know, Batman and Joker, you've got, you know, Batman, who's incredibly brilliant, you know, everything. He's got a plan for everything. And when he doesn't have a plan, he's got a plan for not having a plan, you know. Mm-hmm. So what's the only way to counter that? Well, someone who someone who doesn't make any sense at all. You know, for someone who reasons everything out, the best way to defeat him is with someone who can't be reasoned with.
Right. Yeah. Well, so now in this, in the more modern take on their relationship, we're going into what feels very similar to the Sherlock Moriarty relationship that we've had televised of late, you know, and that kind of a, as you said, meticulous planning, the off the handle nutbag of a nemesis, who is just as intelligent, if not more so, and their battles of wits become more more dangerous because of the fact that there's so much more collateral damage. So I guess when we come into Sim, you were mentioning specifically talking about the fact that the when the plan, the doctor, the master's plans get unraveled all through from second to seventh doctor or so, or even eighth, mm-hmm. if you want to count the film in there as well. But they're always undone by that one little detail that hasn't been considered,
yeah.
That sort of thing. The element that that I know, even in Terror of the Autons, when the master realizes that his plan could potentially backfire because he could be, you know, his life is at risk as well, that really parallels with when we see in Utopia, Sound of the Drums, you know, Last of the Time Lords, that when they're standing on the surface, the rockets are about to go off and the new war upon the universe is about to begin, launched from Earth. It's the doctor brings to the master's realization that his life is on the line as well. You know, if he right. activates the black hole manipulator, you know, he's just as much at risk as everyone else because he's standing on the surface of ground zero. So nothing has changed in the grand scheme. It's a larger scale and there's a lot more collateral damage to be accounted for. Mm-hmm. But the repercussions are still the same. He's overlooked something critical. His life is on the line. He talks too much. Does way too much villainous exposition.
You're monologuing, Master.
How are we supposed to know otherwise?
So my question for you, Haley, is in terms of that sort of a thing, using that as your baseline, looking back then and seeing it's sort of the path leading up to it, do you see the foundation or do you see a wholly different character?
I've always saw the Master as, you know, the dark reflection of the doctor he's pitted against, he or she. So I think you're still seeing that at this point. I don't have a lot of familiarity with this doctor yet. I mean, this is the first Pertwee mm-hmm. episode I've seen, but it still seems like that's the nature of their relationship.
Okay. Well, that's a really interesting point. So you're saying that rather than, you know, doctor goes through his iterations, he makes shifts not only in appearance, but in personality as driven by, as we've been sort of looking at the master plan or the way the behavior has gone, that his each regeneration sort of goes to focus in on some aspect that his predecessor either lacked or missed or something, and there's some sort of a correction. You know, you're not close enough to humans. We're going to make you younger and dapper and charming and things so you can win humanity's love back. Okay, you've got humanity's love now, but now you become too wishy-washy, so we're going to make you bitter and surly.
Didn't have eyebrows, so now you have attack eyebrows.
Yes, we're giving you three times the eyebrows. So you sort of see the master as mirroring the doctor along his path rather than following his own path as he goes from regen to regen?
Right. Well, and I've got, you know, limited information to go off of, but we had Tennant versus Sims, and I feel like Tennant, you know, he was kind of the precursor to the arrogance that we saw with Smith's doctor. And you get him to the point where he's, you know, staring down armadas of aliens, you know, no second chances, that kind of thing. And then you get the Master coming along, and he has the same level of arrogance, only his goal is to rule the world instead of protect it. Mm-hmm. And then...
Or burn it.
You know, whatever. Whatever floats your boat. And then we've got Capaldi, and we've got Gomez, and his journey this whole season has seemed to be like, who am I? What do I really want? And it seemed like we got a similar story from Gomez's mistress.
Mm.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, then, Jay, take us there. Where do we stand right now? If we've gone through and we've had our classic experience for 30-odd years of the two of them sort of locking horns from an intellectual standpoint, and he would occasionally recruit another species to sort of go through his plans. We get up into the RTD era, and we're following a similar formula, but where do you start seeing the modernization diverge?
Yeah, I'd honestly, it's in the, you know, no holds barred kind of approach that he takes, where, you know, even from the beginning, you know, Delgado had no problem killing people. Like, you know, oh, hey, you're in my way. Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and kill you now. It's just easier, less of a mess. And so, you know, the homicidal nature has always been there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one could even argue up to genocidal nature, you know, but he just never made it that far. He was willing to, he just couldn't actually do it. But it was I feel like with the change where he almost didn't care what the repercussions were. As you know, with John Sims' Master, he got to the point where it was like everything for this goal. Everything mm-hmm. is, you know, is admissible as long as this is achieved. And I feel like that took it to a whole new level of danger, because, you know, with the previous Masters, it was always, you know, look, I'm going to sit you down and I'm going to explain why this plan doesn't work. And at the end of that, you're going to come with me and help me figure out how to solve it or get out of my way so that I can take care of it. Mm. And here you had the Master fighting the Doctor till the bitter end. You know, not, you know, once his plan was shown to be flawed, it didn't matter. You know, he was like, too late. I'm already committed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was in that moment where it was like, okay, well, you know, this isn't working anymore. And it did kind of push everything forward and make it more dangerous, because at this point it's no longer, you know, let me figure out the plan. It's okay, I have to actually figure out an action to stop it.
I wanted to check with you since this gave you the opportunity to get, and I know that you've watched them often enough, but that trio, you know, mm-hmm. that power trio, Utopia, Drums, Last Time Lord. When it all culminates down to the death scene, you know, and he's holding him, you know, Doctor screaming at him to regenerate, that is the one moment where, after all of this new history that we've been given, not only about each of our characters, but the entire, you know, Gallifreyan experience, you know, the untempered schism and mm-hmm. the cultivating of young Time Lords at the Citadel. I mean, everything. Well, we were handed so much material that we could chew on. And we get this story about the two of them where they're nearly brothers, and it's almost handed to us on a silver platter.
Right.
We've got one dying in the other's arms, and to the last breath, the Master is still reveling, giggling in the fact that he's won.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no final moment for redemption. There is no last glimpse, you know, moment of clarity before death, anything of that sort. Does that fit?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does, because when you have him beaten, you know, almost on a weekly basis throughout the classic series, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, every time he comes up with something, the Doctor beats him, and he comes up with a new thing and the Doctor beats him, and it's just a constant thing. I think he finally got to the point to where he snapped and he said, you know what, as long as I can beat the Doctor, I don't care anymore. And it just became something that happens. You see this a lot when, you know, when kids are bullied constantly, and, you know, it becomes something that I'm going to get even with this bully, and I don't care what the consequences are. When you get pushed that many times, when you get, you know, smacked down and told, no, you can't do that so many times, it's going to break you at some point. And I think given the millennia that, or the, you know, the centuries that these guys had lived at this point, you know, constantly doing this over and over and over again. Yeah. I think he finally broke. And I think that had this happened with one of the classic Doctors, it might not have fit. But because it had been so long, because it had been such an ongoing thing, and because the relationship was so close, I think it makes sense that he finally just snapped and said, you know what, as long as I can beat him, I don't care.
Okay. Well, then I guess that carries us well to where we are at present. And I say carries us well because it gives us something very contradictory and something that where the number of questions that it raises are that much stronger. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, if you want to go back, you watch the last 30 seconds of Last of the Time Lords, and you get the moment at the base of the funeral pyre where, you know, now in retrospect, it makes so much more freaking sense to see the hand with the fingernail polish reach down and pick up the Master's ring, and you hear Missy's giggle or cackle or call it whatever you will. We know that if the ring has similar capabilities to the watch in being able to transfer consciousness or anything of that sort, maybe that body was dead. Maybe there was a matter of the consciousness was locked within the ring so that it could then take over. You know, there's many ways that we could play out the survival of the Master beyond the death throes that we previously saw. But now we've got a lot more character motivation for our nemesis, because she has now seen how much the Doctor wanted them to survive. And it was more than just I'm going to keep you under lock and key, kind of, you know, keep an eye on you within my TARDIS. This was really, I wanted a flesh and blood companion, you know, one of my own, my extended family with me. And so Missy can work that any way she wants.
Well, are you, okay, not to derail you here, but are you forgetting that we got another encounter with Sim's Master, though?
I'm not necessarily, no, because what I'm picking up the needle and putting it down later on the record here.
Okay.
Because I want to say that since we were kind of choosing these moments, we wanted to take Terror for our first introduction to the Master, sort of get an idea of what his headspace was at the time.
Yeah.
Then we jump ahead to Sim and see as he's being driven mad by the implants placed by the Time Lords, and then jumping all the way to where we are at present, with Gomez's interpretation, where the madness has now been tenfold intensified. We thought Sim was nuts. Gomez is
bananas.
Exactly. So if in going with Haley's theory about the idea of, you know, you always have to have that perfect dark mirror, then that means that wherever the Doctor is within himself right now, that the Master is the twisted interpretation or the twisted counterpart to that. And the Doctor is trying to, has just now come to terms with the fact that he knows his path. He's not going to label it a good or a bad path. It is just the right path. Then where does that mean that the Master is heading along? Because I think that they're doing more with the Master now. They have the freedom to do more with her character and a character arc than just being there to have some big plan to be unraveled every 6 to 7 episodes or whatever the formula may be.
Right. You know, the thing that everybody seemed to get hung up on is the fact that, you know, Missy did all of this supposedly for the Doctor she told him, I did all this for you. It's a gift to you. I want you to have an army because, you know, what purpose do I have for it? And everyone's like, well, why after all this time would the Master help the Doctor? And I think it's in that fact that they are basically mirror images. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's just that one aspect that's flipped that makes them different. And I think that at this point, the Master, Missy, has seen that, has recognized that aspect. And it's, you know, if she can corrupt the Doctor, if she can give him an arm, if she can make him, you know, the evil that she always was, then would that either redeem or, you know, vindicate her?
I think that's what I was kind of digging at. Because if we had at the end of Last of the Time Lords, when the Master is dying in his arms, and the Doctor wants to pull him back so that he can have a companion, And he actually kind of indicates that this is really not just a matter of, you know, this is something where the two of us can, you know, can find some sort of redemption for our race that has done has perpetuated these atrocities and so forth. I think it's a nice parallel or at least a bookend to what Missy Master was attempting to do in Death in Heaven, and put the Doctor into a position where, you know, look at what you've got. You've got this opportunity where you could have it all. I personally, if I were to have it all, I might do something a little outside the moral code. But you could do it, and I'll stick around. I'll just be there to, you know, as your yes man, or just to pat you on the back and say, nice job, boss.
Right.
It's a very interesting duality between the two, where they know how to get at one another at a very base level, but they're coming at it from the most polar opposite ends.
Yeah. Haley, what do you think about the turn that they took with this series?
What are you talking about?
I mean, with introducing Missy and the way that her character is compared to where the character has come from.
Well, you know, Keir was also talking about how the Master's growth can be like the Doctor's growth is, where he's changing in each regeneration to adapt to something that he was flawed in the previous incarnation. And, you know, I think that still relates to the dark reflection thing too, because if he's adapting to a problem in the previous regeneration and he's following a parallel path to the Doctor, then you're still going to see some of these same tendencies.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. So we've gotten to the point now where Missy is either trying to find redemption or just trying to find a new purpose, or, you know, reevaluating her stance on everything. Because up to this point, the Master had always been like, you know, my goal is world domination or galactic domination, or, you know, I need to subjugate some peoples to X degree. Yeah. And here we have, you know, this is the first really well televised story that we've gotten where it didn't fit into that. It was like, I'm not trying to rule over anyone this time. And it seems like it's such a dynamic change for the formula that the character did have, that it's interesting to see how it all kind of fits with everything else. So what do we think that this means for the character moving forward at this point?
I think it's going to become far more cerebral. They are, at least in a single direction, this is going to be one of those things where instead of being solely a war of intellect, where it's a matter of a chess game between the two, this is something where there's going to be a lot more emotional investment on both sides, because this is where we start getting into Moffat territory and saying that, okay, if I can find something where it's this big visceral conflict between two warring sides, but now you put heart and emotion into it, you've got action drama to the nth degree. And now I think, as far as what we've seen, where it went from the classic approaches where it was the Bond and Bond villain conflicts, then we get into all up through Sim and what they've been doing in the Big Finish work with Dark Eyes and those things, where those representations of the Doctor around 8th, 9th, 10th, and the Master's interactions at that point, where it's far more a matter of the juxtaposing their common grounds as the challenge between them. We're too similar to be this different in terms of the way that they war with one another. And now going forward with Missy, they have the opportunity to be able to say, now we can put a lot of the intellectual aside, because as you were saying, you know, you talk about the Batman Joker dichotomy, that you've got someone who's far too unpredictable to be accounted for by planning.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're strictly on the reactionary rather than the proactionary. Proaction? Is that a word? Who the hell cares? But so now the only thing that you can fall back on is they have to try to appeal to one another at that more base level. So now the chess game is over, and now it's a matter of sort of trying to trip each other up by going at each other through emotional means, which the Doctor has not tried to play yet, because that's just not within his present nature, but the Master seems to have that down. You know, she called his numbers to a T.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of being able to plot out a plan that this time around was not about the domination. You thought it was until the very last moment. And then she hands the keys over, essentially, and says, here. That's something that we've never considered the Master to be capable of before, because it is such a high-risk move. Yeah. Didn't end up working, But it says something about the direction that they could go with the character.
But at the same time, if you look at it, it does fit into the old formula of she had everything planned out except for the fact that, you know, basically Danny's love for Clara would be able to override everything she was doing. Mm. If it hadn't been for his feelings towards her, then they probably wouldn't have been able to stop the clouds.
Yep. Well, you have to have a loose thread somewhere.
Yeah. It is that exact same, you know, it's like you had everything planned out to the nth degree except for this one thing. And this is what makes your whole plan fall apart. Right. And so, I mean, it's still, yes, it's a new face on it, but it is still that same kind of story.
We do see that there is a residual effect. You know, the Master had been vanquished this time around, sent back to the Nether Sphere to plot out whatever the next move is going to be. Mm-hmm. But the lingering effect on the Doctor, you know, the misleading information about the location of Gallifrey and those things, that's going to have to fester for a while.
Yeah.
So I guess one of the great questions going forward is, on whatever their next interaction is going to be, whether it is a matter of another one of these highly orchestrated plans that we come into, you know, 8 steps out of 10 into the process, and we've got to, you know, come up to full speed to try and deal with it. We're right alongside. Look at us go. Or is it something where the Doctor goes on the hunt? You know, is he really searching for Gallifrey for a little while, or does he have to close this chapter before he can deal with anything else, because this is the more immediate concern? And now that he doesn't have, or as far as we know in the storyline at the moment, until, you know, Christmas comes around in a couple of weeks, Clara's not there to be the restraint. Mm-hmm. Does he plan to go off and try and solve this on his own, unchecked?
Do you think something's going to happen to make him believe that Missy is still alive before he finds out that she is?
No. If they did, it would be a very... It would be a very, very dynamic change from what they have done, because it's always been the Master just popping up when he or she is ready to reveal himself. So if they did something to where the Doctor understood, oh, wait, I didn't kill her, she's going to come back, it would be a very big departure from the norm. Hmm. So that might be exactly what they need to do, but I don't expect it to happen.
Okay. Hmm.
I think one of the things that's always fascinated me about the two of them is the fact that there have been many instances where there's been mortal peril involved, you know, and the Master has always been, once he gets his exposition out, he's prepared to kill the Doctor, you know, 9-10 times over. The Doctor always restrains because he feels some sort of an obligation to not necessarily bring the Master back from the brink of his madness, that's too far gone, but save him, you know, in whatever way you want to interpret that line, you know. And I think Tennant's Doctor even said it, you know, he said, I have to, he's my responsibility. I'm not here to kill him, I'm here to save him.
Yeah.
But at this point, you know, we know that at the end of Death in Heaven, he was prepared to do so for Clara's benefit. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure. I honestly don't know. Even if the Cyberbrig hadn't really kind of jumped in when he did, I don't know if the Doctor would have actually ended up finally pulling the trigger, so to speak. Or whether there would have been one of those moments where he would have paused to say, you know what, a fitter punishment would be to have him living with the repercussions of yada, 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 yada. Mm-hmm. I don't think that even our current Doctor, as bitter and disdainful as he is, could allow that to happen, especially after Missy had called his number so closely.
All right, so let me ask you guys this, and going back to the Batman Joker comparison one more time, you know, the thing that always irritates me is the fact that every time the Joker comes back and kills someone, it's on Batman because he didn't do something more permanent to end the Joker's reign of terror. You know, it's like, oh, I'm going to put you in this box. Don't get out of the box. Oh, you got out of the box again. Here, back in the box. Don't get out of the box this time. You know, and you have to think if it, at that point, it's Batman's fault for not doing it. So what is it that's making the Doctor feel this kinship towards the Master to the point where it doesn't matter what you do, I'm always going to give you that one more chance to, you know, not do it?
Because that's all he has left. It's just the two of them left. And no matter what else happens, they are, for lack of a better word, family, you know, brothers or whatever.
Mm. Okay.
I think, well, if that may be something that serves as a protection up to a point, maybe this is something where we're looking at a far longer sort of literary arc here. But if it's something, if that is the saving grace up to this point, and the fact that the last two of our kind sort of approach, then that allows us, because of the fact that we have no verification that Gallifrey persists, that if the Doctor does not choose to let that go and wants to determine for himself whether or not that possibility is still out there, once that is determined, and that it is not a matter of my being the last of my kind or us two being the last of our kind, now the restraints are off. Now you're no longer protected by saying, oh, but you know, you're a Time Lord, and I'm a Time
Right,
Lady.
We're the only ones left, yeah.
Of our kind, except for these hundreds of others standing here behind me. I don't know.
Well, and that kind of asks the question, like, what was it that stopped him throughout the classic series? Yeah, I mean, I know there's plenty of times where it was just, oh, look, I'm jumping in my conveniently placed TARDIS and getting away. It's, you know, but there were times when the Doctor would, you know, would actually take the path of least resistance, so to speak, and just put him in, you know, lock him up or whatever.
Depending on the instance that you want to refer to, sometimes it was as a matter of moral code. At other times it was because of the fact that the Doctor honestly felt that there was a way that he could bring him back. Mm-hmm. In other instances, it was really just a matter of there was the convenient script interruption that allowed for the getaway or, you know, being, slingshot off into space somewhere in a ship and free right. Of the conflict. So I don't know that there was necessarily in all of the writers' minds throughout that there was a consistent message, some note card somewhere that was, you know, stapled to the wall that said, don't forget.
Yeah.
Doctor needs to protect the Master because he's actually his little brother or anything of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
They could go ahead and craft that into the mythology if they wanted to at a later point. But I think it was just a matter of it was really coming down to a far more basic formula of Doctor and villain need to persist because you've got to have the perfect foil.
Yeah.
And as Haley was saying, you know, what better foil than just to have, you know, the darkened image of your hero.
Right.
Yeah. Some people are just too interesting to die.
Because reasons, that's why. All right, so now that we've kind of taken a walk through the Master's timeline, what is it that you guys would like to see for the character most in the future? Not necessarily Series 9, but just as the show goes on, the next time that we see her pop up.
Infrequency. I think we've discussed this before, but yeah. I don't want this to become formulaic.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I would agree infrequent, but I would like one long, constant interaction. Like, for some reason, they have to spend the entire episode together, or maybe a two-episode arc or something together.
Yeah. You know, I've mentioned it before, but the thing that I would love to see is I would love to see the two of them at the culmination of this whole hunt for Gallifrey thing. I want to see either, you know, the Master trying to stop him from finding Gallifrey and they have to go against each other for that reason, or something about, you know, we have to stop Gallifrey coming back for this reason or whatever, and they have to work together. Yeah, I want to see that conflict because let's face it, they're both from Gallifrey. It would make sense that they would both be there for its return. Mm-hmm. So I do want to see that all kind of culminate together, but I'm not sure whether I want it to be, you know, I'm going against the Master again because he's stopping, or if it's going to be, you know, we have to work together for this reason.
I'm always hesitant of the script situations where where side A and side B have to work together against the common thread. That feels a little contrived, unless it's done in a very, very slick or unexpected fashion. The moment I see that happen, it just feels, you know, feels very cookie cutter to me.
Yeah.
But if this is something where it's being done for a new reason or something that is that propels the story, or I should say propels canon into a new direction, mm-hmm. you know, like the idea of how quickly we forget that all the rest of the Time Lords are equally assholes, and now they're back and they're being their usual high collared prick selves,
and
the only two that have been repeatedly able to be manipulated by them and yet outsmart them at every step were their two most intelligent rogues. So that's sort of a partnership I can get behind, because it's a, you know, I like that aspect of it. But again, that brings us back to something that we've also discussed, is do we really want the Time Lords back?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, and that's kind of the story that I'm thinking towards, is, you know, there's something, okay, we found Gallifrey and hey, they're coming back. Crap, here's, you know, reason X, Y, and Z why they shouldn't be here. And they both recognize it, and they're both like, well, you know, we're both trying to stop this. Why don't we call a ceasefire kind of thing? And you're right. That is a very, very overly used thing. And I don't want to see it just because, hey, here it is again. But I do think, I mean, let's face it, Moffat's going to be writing the story for, to sum up this whole Hunt for Gallifrey thing. It's his pet. That's what he's going to do. Mm-hmm. I think that he, given what I saw from the 50th and through the episodes in series 8 that we've just seen, I think he could do it. I think he could come up with a logical, to a point, and cohesive story as to why they would have to work together.
So,
given the right writer, given the right person behind it, I think that it would work.
Okay. I guess I will give Moffat credit that a lot of times he is definitely thinking in terms of the longer term aspect of the program. He does see it as much of a business as he does as a story. Mm-hmm. And as such, that decision as to whether or not, you know, the actual regular return of Gallifrey and the repercussions that could happen to the show, I know he's perfectly aware of those things, you know, the same way we're concerned about them. What he chooses to do with that, how he chooses to approach that, or what solutions he has to be able to allow that either to happen or decide not to make it happen, I'm going to give him, you know, all the space that he needs to hash those things out. You're welcome, Steven. I officially give that to you. But I, as far as how that ties in to the Master, I mean, obviously that is our strongest thread back to the Time War, the Lock, the everything that we've been dealing with, on again, off again, retconned, restored, time rolled back, however you want to deal with it, on mm-hmm. how many iterations over the course of the last couple of seasons. We know that he loves returning to Gallifrey.
Yeah.
It's a landscape, and it's a palette. It's an artist's palette that he loves working with, because of the fact that it's something that has not really gotten a lot of overt attention. You know, we've had listeners that have said, you know, where can I go grab, other than just some of the televised stuff, where can I grab more of the Gallifrey and backstory? There's a book out there called The Gallifrey Chronicles that you can get, which is really sort of a compendium that pulls together all the information that's been culled about life on Gallifrey and those things. You can read through that. It's interesting stuff. But as far as where the story can go from here, he's got a very clear path of what I knew the moment the no more premise started to play into it, that he knew exactly where and when and to what extent the return is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, will the fan base as a whole be as willing to accept that as they have? Because you've seen the polarity in the reactions to the 50th and everything that stirred up, the return of the Master and everything that stirred up, the Doctor's direction right now, where that's turned up. the false threat of the location of Gallifrey and those things. Mm-hmm. I've been reading all over a lot of reactions about people saying this is just another proof that that Moffat has no rudder in the water, and that as long as he just leaves it cloudy, then, you know, he can call himself a genius because he, you know, he throws in all these references and he stirs people up emotionally and actually says nothing. And that's the, you know, the torchbearers and the pitchforks.
We like to call that Moffat-splaining.
Well, it is, but to an extent, is that really valid? And I know we're kind of straying here a little bit, but this idea of playing this Return of the Master card is something that I think shows that he does have a rudder in the water.
Yeah.
You know, he does have the means not only to be able to come up with a fairly intricate plot line, but be able to execute it in a way that, you know, like it or not, you got to give credit to the fact that it was engaging and unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
And executed well for what it was. Whether or not it's something you wanted to see, it was pulled off extremely well. Yeah. Does he have the same kind of momentum, or do you think, you know, is the Gallifreyan question mark out there larger than this, you know, as far as the way that he played this little mystery, and can he execute it with the same dexterity?
Yeah, I think that is going to be the thing that he puts up. That's going to be the screen that he shoves in everyone's face saying, hey, look, you know, this is what I've got going on. Don't pay attention to what I'm doing back here with the master and bringing this back and, you know, laying out all these threads. Pay attention to this thing up here. And hey, look, I'm taking that away and look what I've created here. Because okay. That's what he tends to do, is he will put the big stuff out there and be like, focus on this, pay attention to this. And then when that gets taken away, you know, most of the time you've got fans that are very upset. They're like, wait, what happened to the thing I was looking at? Why? I don't care about that stuff behind it. It doesn't matter how brilliantly scripted it was. What about this thing that you had in front of my face that you never said anything more about? You know,
Haley.
I feel like we're going to start getting more about Gallifrey soon. So I'm hesitant to say too much about how much he's going to hide and how much he's going to reveal. But I do think the master is going to tie into all of it, and that it's all going to be connected in some way, because you can't bring the master back when his disappearance was tied so closely to the loss of Gallifrey and then not address Gallifrey again.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a good point, too, because, I mean, we never got the explanation to, you know, how she escaped, why she's back when, you know, for all reasons, she should still be in that time lock.
Escaped, right. Or was let out again.
Right.
Yeah.
And why she would be the only one that's back.
Nice. Yeah. So it's definitely something that we're going to have to keep our eye on, because it is something that's coming back. But we actually posed the question to some of our listeners as to what their favorite master was and what the favorite aspects, and just, you know, what about the character you liked most. And we got a response on Twitter from at Missy Doctor Who, and she said, really?
So, pretty clear indication there.
Yeah, fair point. Badger was a little bit more wordy with his response. He said, the master is the doctor's foil. Two sides of the same coin. That was Missy's point. Behind all of the general madness, change just a few circumstances, and the two are interchangeable. They're both unique, if that can be a thing, in Time Lord society. They live outside the normal rules and want to shape time and space to fit their own notion of how the universe should function. As for the best, I'm not sure. Ainley was, quote-unquote, my master growing up, but I don't think that sort of mustache-twirling villain works anymore. Derek Jacobi is easily the best actor to play him ever, but obviously his contribution was limited. So I'm torn between Sims and Gomez. Both had moments of nuanced and over-the-top evil. Not sure I can decide, honestly. Mm. So, you know, I have to agree with them that they both had some great aspects to them. But if I were pushed, I'd have to side on the side of Gomez, but that's just me.
I mean, I don't have a lot of master exposure at this point, but Missy is my master.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I like Delgado. I think Delgado was great for the character that he was playing. Mm-hmm. I don't think that kind of character and that kind of story holds up very well in this day and age. So if you can take it, you know, put it in a little bubble and, you know, time doesn't affect it, then he was fantastic.
Sure.
But if you're going to look at it in today's standards, okay, which of these two characters do you think is best? I have to go with Gomez.
Okay. And that is a very tough call. I mean, as far as the most recent iterations of the Master, in terms of being able to go the criminally insane route,
mm-hmm.
rather than just, you know, criminal mastermind, is a very, very tough call between the two. Sim has his characteristics because of the fact that he could pull back and just be charming.
Yeah.
And just be affable and that sort of thing, which I don't think Missy can turn that off. I don't think she can just be pleasant and sweet and just have a have a seat over here in the settee and enjoy a cup of tea. No, because she's going to come at your throat in about 15 seconds.
But, right.
Yeah,
I think that a lot of the difference between Gomez and Sims is the danger level. Because, you know, obviously Sim was trying to control the world and was, you know, you were in danger from him. But with Missy, it's a more immediate danger. It's not this grand scheme that's going to ruin all of humanity. It's,
she's,
you know,
gonna
what?
Snap your neck right now.
Just because you're on my nerves, I'm going to go ahead and end you. You know, and that's, it's a more immediate danger. And I think that's why I like her more, because it's a fear that you feel like instantly. It's no longer the, you know, oh man, the world's going to end. It's, oh crap, this girl's going to kill me.
Right. Anything could happen at any second.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a lot of the draw for Missy versus the other iterations, is just the way that they framed her danger.
Right.
So. Then I found this very, very interesting that they would put this on this week. But if you go to DoctorWhoTV.co.uk, they actually have a poll on right now, and they've been facing Masters against each other, and they're finally down to the final round. And it is, interestingly enough, Roger Delgado versus Michelle Gomez.
Okay.
So I don't know how long this poll is going on, or you can't see results yet, so I'm assuming it's still going. But you can go and cast your vote and see what happens there.
Vote early, vote often.
Polls.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Then we've got some other news coming up, too. Michelle Gomez actually did an interview. And I don't know if you guys read through this, but it is absolutely hilarious.
Yeah. She's got to be great to talk with. I mean, she was very sharp on her responses, but also had some really interesting stuff to be able to contribute as well. Just as far as, I mean, they were talking about some goofy stuff like action figures and that sort of thing. You know, she was really kind of excited about all that. But just in terms of the keeping of the secret, the idea of the gender flip on the character, and what the repercussions would that mean for how the fan base would react to her. And those things. I think she really gets it as an actor. It's really not just a matter of someone who takes on the role and says, oh, well, you know, I did a little bit of research. You know, I prep my lines. I do these things. No, she really thought this out and wanted to make sure that she understood the character's past, where it was headed, and in terms of what she was going to be doing with it, what the repercussions were going to be in terms of what she was going to expect as a reaction from the viewing public.
Well, and you know, a great example of that is there's one quote in here that I love, and they were asking her about conventions and stuff, and the interviewer said, Doctor Who conventions, have you been briefed, stroked, warned about them? And her response, I love that, she said, I haven't been stroked, no. But then she goes on to explain, she said, no, that I think the Master should just go away. I don't think we should have too much public exposure of the Master. So, like, I think that, you know, she says, unless you pay me a lot of money. So I think that she's one of those people, she would love to get out there and meet the fans, and she would love to get out there and actually be a part of it. But she understands that for the character that she's playing, it's more effective if she doesn't do that.
Right.
So it does really show that she does understand the character that she's been picked to play. Oh, I love reading through that. So yeah, definitely go and click on that link and enjoy that interview, because it is fantastic to read.
Mm-hmm. They cut out the part of the interview where she told the interviewer to sit on the bed.
Yeah. No, that's exclusive for us. That's it only happens for GPR.
When she says it, it's a command.
And Kier faints.
Then this is news that is well past its time. It is good thing that it is finally coming. Mm-hmm. But Doctor Who is finally seeing its first female writer since 2008 coming back for Series 9.
Yes. And it's not just going to be an actual stranger to the universe whatsoever, because this is one of our previous Torchwood writers, mm-hmm. Catherine Tregana. So this is going to be, I think, finally, you talk about kind of your glass ceiling approach. This is definitely going to be a matter of setting more of a trend, because this is something that was driven by Carolyn Skinner.
Yeah. You know,
this is something that she specifically wanted to make sure that she was correcting as part of her tenure. So this is, whether it's, Jane Espenson or I would love to see Espenson actually on a full Who episode. That'd be absolutely nerds. This has gone from rumor to confirmation within the past week. So obviously no details about anything from script related or anything of that sort. Yeah. But I think that she was approached rather than her pitching script. So which always makes a difference in terms of whether or not you're going to be getting something where the producer's desks say, we need something that's going to drive this aspect of the story, and we're giving you this villain, mm-hmm. go. As opposed to her coming back and saying, I want to bring back the Slitheen, or whatever the case may be. It could be the Absorbalot. I want to redeem that. So we'll see. I was just really pleased when that news article started coming down, because the rumor mill had been going around for a little while, and it finally locked in. It was confirmed by the Biebs. That means that it may not be the only one that we see just for this season, because they haven't really locked down a lot of the slots for season 9.
But the fact that this is the first female writer that we've gotten since 2008, and only the second one since the show has come back since 2005. So I'd say it's well beyond time for this to start happening. So I'm happy that we got at least one. Least one is confirmed. Yeah. Do we want to talk about this one?
No.
You know what? I'll just go so far as saying this. If you're a writer, if you're an author, and you're trying to get publicity for your book series, you know who you are, and you decide under the advisement of your marketing agency to drop Doctor Who references in as a way to promote your crappy book series, and actually pitch yourself as someone who's being considered as a writer for the show because your books are so good. Don't.
Yeah.
I'm being considered as a writer for the show, too. Yep.
I actually wrote three scripts. Incredibly reliable sources like me. Quote, yeah. Incredibly reliable
sources. Does this come from one of your reliable sources? No. This is one of my incredibly reliable sources.
My grandma.
I mean, I tried to do my due diligence with this, and I actually went and I searched the guy's name, and we don't even want to mention him. I don't want to drive traffic to it, but
you only found his name on his webpage.
The very first article, the very first thing that popped up on Google was something from a website that had nothing to do with his writing or anything else. It was his political or religious stance, and then the next five were off social media. Off of his Twitter and his Facebook and his, his fan page or Facebook or whatever it's called.
Self-promotion.
And then everything else after that was links to his books on like Amazon. So I'm not seeing a lot of traction here. So yeah.
Yeah. Sound the bogus horn. Bogus. Yeah. So not giving that any more of our time. Do we even want to include that in the link dump?
No. I'm going to take that out.
All right. Got it.
All right.
But you insist on putting these things in.
Yes, I do.
Oh, look. Crappy lists.
There aren't enough lists on the internet.
Because everyone loves a list. That's why.
And they got to scatter it across like 12 pages. You can't just read the whole list.
We're talking about writers. This kind of fits, and I want to gauge opinions here, because some of these are absolutely laughable. Like, so we've got the five Doctor Who writers who should return for series 9, and then plus five new ones. Mm-hmm. And the number five who should return, and it's going to happen. We know it's going to happen, but I still laugh at it and want it not to. It is Mark Gatiss. Mm-hmm. It's going to happen. You don't have to put him in a list. He's going to come back. I mean,
Of course he is. And he's doing that just to spite you.
Oh, I know. We've exchanged emails and we're just going at it. And
He's your nemesis, isn't he?
This is purely vindictive on his part. And believe me, my retaliation will be epic.
He's always very
He's
going to
write a scathing blog post. 10 reasons why I hate Mark Gatiss.
He gets the extra clacky keyboard out for that one.
Oh, yes.
Bing!
And then he's going to make a phone call with like a dial with a rotary phone so we can slam it down.
I said good day, sir.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, and I've said it before. I love Mark Gatiss. I think that he's a fantastic writer. I just do not like him writing for Doctor Who. But
okay. Who else is on the list, Jake?
So the next one is Toby Whithouse.
Yeah.
You know, and his first introduction to the series goes back to, it was actually, I think he wrote for Torchwood first. That was, he kind of like worked his way back in, you know, through the back door. Mm. But, you know, he's got titles to his name like The Vampires of Venice and The God Complex and A Town Called Mercy. Not horrible episodes.
But not your favorites.
Yeah, definitely middling to lower kind of. So
He writes good romps.
Yeah, he does. But that's not really what we want from this doctor too much.
But you need them occasionally, so you give Toby a ring.
Yeah. Or, no, actually, I take that back. His first writing for the show was actually a school reunion. So he's the one that brought Sarah Jane back to meet the 10th Doctor. So you get credit there. And then the next one we've got is Paul Cornell, who wrote Father's Day. So, okay. I'd give him another shot because I like Father's Day.
Right. Yeah. I feel like that's the kind of episode that Moffat would keep for himself now.
Yeah.
Although definitely. Yeah.
And he actually returned for the Human Nature and Family of Blood two-parter. So I can fully support this guy coming back. Granted, yes, that was an adapted script, but still.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah. No, it was great. And then number two is Neil Gaiman.
Of course.
Yeah. Nothing else to say there. And then number one, Russell T. Davies.
Well, here's what I think. It's one of those things where if you can take somebody and take the pressures of the rest of the job, the showrunner job, off your shoulders and allow you to just focus on your story work, and given some of the freedoms that would provide him, don't you think that he could come up with something really, really engaging?
Yeah. I didn't care for his style of storytelling, which was all, you know, build up, crap, I gotta wrap this up, magic wand.
Okay, but bear in mind that is after edits, revisions, production modifications,
opposed to it, I just don't see it happening.
I think there's too much mud in the water for that to happen right now.
And I wasn't really following the behind-the-scenes stuff. Doesn't he have a bit of an ego?
Of course.
So do you really think he would come back if he wasn't in charge?
Well, you got to think. He's one of the people who was instrumental to bringing the show back. So he is a fan, first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And I think that being a part of the show would be more important than, you know, having his ego stroked. But
it could be a very big ego inflation to say, I'm back. I have deemed it worthy of my time and my effort to pen an episode for the show because my love for the show and for all of you is so great, you know, that I've decided to come back and make another contribution. And the press would have an absolute carnival with it. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that our favorite prodigal son, but as far as our great redeemer who brought our show back from the darkness.
Mm-hmm.
Has come back one more time to share another story with us. Gather round, kids, sit by the fire.
You know? Oh, and then the list goes on to include some new names that they want to see. Number five, J.K. Rowling. So, yeah, obviously. I would love to see an episode from her. It might be complete crap, but I want to see at least one go with it.
I don't know what her grasp of the universe may be in order to put something together that could be, you know, could be enjoyable, but might just be such a deviation from a story that we understood.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Rings of Agaton. Sorry.
Something get caught in your throat there?
Yeah. Number four, Christopher Nolan.
Okay. It's going to be deep.
Yeah.
In the next 2 hour and 15 minute long episode of Doctor Who,
part one. And then number three is, as Kier mentioned, Jane Espenson.
Hell yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one I would like to see.
Mm-hmm.
If she hasn't earned her stripes, nobody has. Male or female, I don't care.
Oh, yeah. Then number two is Charlie Brooker, who I honestly don't know who the heck he is, so I can't say one way or the other.
Charlie Brooker. Is there anything credited in the article as far as what we know?
He's got credits, but I haven't heard of him.
Dead Set and Black Mirror.
Okay.
Don't know. Mm-hmm. So.
Dramatic series. Okay.
And then a gif of him right screaming.
Yeah. Moving right along. And number one, ironically, I don't know when this article came out, but I find it kind of funny. Catherine Tagrina.
Yeah, that'd be a great idea, wouldn't it?
Mm. Yeah. I wonder if they'll actually pull that one together.
It's a cracker of an idea.
It's a cracker.
Yeah. So actually, this article was first posted on November 26th. When was the...
Tagrina news was like the 24th. So nice job, guys.
Really on the ball.
So not only are you writing a list article, but you're using a list article where your primary point is based on three-day-old news. So, hey, do we have another list article that we could talk about, Jay?
We sure do.
Yay.
I know this is exciting.
List articles all through the hiatus. It's going to be great. We're going to do a list of list articles.
There is no shortage of list articles. No, this one's just five characters we want back in Series 9. And some of these make sense. Some of these are just fans being whiny little babies.
So wait a second. Take 3 seconds to lock in your list of five characters. Ready? Okay, you got them? Here's another five entirely.
I don't know. My entire list is on here. Because my entire list revolves mainly about Brian Pond. Brian Pond, Brian Pond, and Brian Pond. Wow. Oh, and Brian Pond for number one. So.
Okay.
No, but they said Perkins, the engineer from... The Mummy on the Orient Express, who, I mean, we said he was a great character. I wouldn't mind seeing him back, but I don't expect it.
He served his purpose.
Yeah, I don't expect it. But
there'd be no way. I mean, nice idea. How the hell would you execute it?
Exactly. And then, obviously, Brian Pond. Mm-hmm. So, again, yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing more of him, but no, there's no story for him at this point.
Mm. You know what I would like better than Brian Pond is the son from the deleted scene that Brian met.
Oh,
the feels. All the feels. But then it goes on to Journey Blue from Into the Dalek.
Yeah.
That could work, but at the same point, the Doctor left her behind. I don't... Maybe running into her again at some point, but...
Right, but if he didn't take it the first time...
Yeah, I don't think he's gonna... Well, I don't know.
That TARDIS has sailed.
I don't know, because he didn't take Donna the first time, but...
See, you don't want the return of characters that had their shot and missed it, or just, you know, where the book is closed. And I feel with that, when the book is genuinely closed for reasons that they implicitly stated or explicitly stated, better to have someone like Brian Pond, where there has been an established relationship, where again, you know, the story would be very difficult to try and explain why, but in terms of an understanding as to why. The execution may be really tricky, but the premise, the idea of wanting Brian to have another go around with the Doctor, is something that the fans could appreciate.
Yeah. Well, and then the next one is Malcolm from Planet of the Dead.
And what?
I don't remember who this person was.
He was the little scientist guy that was real crazy, and you know, 10 Malcolms equal to Bernard. And
I still don't remember this at all. I have no memory of this.
There's a reason for that.
Yeah, that's true. The number one, and I've just got to say, please, for the love of God, no, Osgood. I love Ingrid Oliver, and I loved Osgood. She was a fantastic character, but if they brought her back, it would undermine everything that her death did in this finale.
Let the dead rest in peace.
Yeah. I mean, this is one where I pray to God that Moffat can just hold it and let this one stick.
Mm-hmm. You know he can't help himself.
I know he can't.
I know. I feel he's learning.
The Moffat Cemetery charges, you know, hourly rates. It's... all right, so let's move on to some actual news now. Yeah. Now that we're done with the list. Yeah. So Catherine Tate, unfortunately, has come out and said that she's not going to return to Doctor Who.
Which is probably not that big of a surprise, but...
No, it's really not. But she is looking to work with David Tennant again in other things. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we can see that duo together again. It's just not going to be, you know, the Doctor and Donna.
No, it's going to be Beatrice and so forth. You know, it's going to be Shakespearean or who knows. And again, like when this first dropped, it was one of those things where, you know, your heart just kind of said, aw.
Yeah.
And it stung for a bit, but you understood.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things that you knew it was coming, but as long as nobody said it, there was still that little glimmer of hope.
It's almost as if you had one of the actors who has once played the Doctor saying, I'm never going to do it. Oh. Never mind. What's the next article to read?
All right. So we've got some, we'll say it's rumors and speculation about the fate of Clara and Jenna Coleman on the show. So if...
do we use our special mirror spoiler tag on this one?
Yeah.
It's not really a spoiler if you consider the fact that the source is the mirror.
Yeah, but if you still just would rather not hear it at all because, you know, a broken watch is still right twice a day, then go ahead. This is our last news story. We saved it for last so that you could go ahead and shut off now and not miss anything else.
Good night, so, everybody.
But for those of you who want to stick around and hear the hilarity that comes from this trash. So apparently the rumor was that Jenna Coleman was going to be leaving after the Christmas special. This was going to be her exit from the show. But now she is asking to stay on through the first half of Series 9. Mm-hmm. So, again, all of this comes from the mirror. Nothing is confirmed. Nothing is, you know, it's very loose idea or very loose information and stuff. So it's a possibility that it's true, but there's no guarantee. Mm-hmm. But
at this point, is there any benefit to the BBC seeding stories like this out to either reputable or less than reputable sources in order to drum up public interest? I mean, can you possibly drum up public interest any more?
No,
than it is?
With the short window, I don't think it's necessary, and I don't think there's a point to it. If it were, you know, if the series had ended in August and we had to wait until Christmas to figure it out, yes, then by all means, leak some information or, you know, tease some stuff, something like that. That way, but I mean, we're talking about a span of 6 weeks. I know that humanity has a short attention span, but come on, like, we're still interested in this. We still are questioning.
Right, and it's going to be the only thing on for weeks on either side of it. So,
yeah. So I don't think that this, if this did come from the BBC, I think it was severely retarded. I'm thinking more that there's someone at the mirror who is like, well, crap, I need to meet my word quota, so let's go back to Doctor Who. That's always a good one.
We got to get more page clicks, guys.
Yeah. So I...
So if you weren't planning on watching the Christmas episode, maybe you might want to tune in now. Something's going to happen.
Okay, so let me ask you guys this. Do you think that the story, I mean, it's hard to really gauge it, but do you think that it would be better for her to leave at the Christmas special and have that clean break? Or do you think that there is enough of her story with the Doctor left to tell that we need another, you know, 8 episodes come Series 9?
I could see it working either way, and I really do want to be surprised. I would like to not know before the Christmas special what's going to happen.
Agreed. But I think that this is a point, this is a natural breaking point here, right, where, you know, if she were to leave the show, this would be a perfect time to do it. If you want to do it on a lighter note and not have it, all of this horrible stuff happened and they parted on bad terms and you want to have more of a repair of the relationship before she exits, I think it's going to need more than just half a season.
No, I don't know about that. I think it needs more than just the Christmas episode to be able to see something, mm-hmm, where it gives justification or gives a proper exit. If you're going to have her come back for the Christmas episode after what we just had,
mm-hmm,
then you at least need a few more stories to close the door properly. Because you're not going to deal with all of that weight and all of that baggage and all of that mess in a Christmas episode.
Yeah.
And one episode, regardless of the fact that it's freaking Santa Claus and, and, you know, and fluffy stuff and we're doing it for the kids. That's not the time or the place or the length of time necessary to work that all out to a point where you can even have anything called a clean break, whether it's happy ending or unhappy ending, it can't even be clean to be wrapped up. So,
you know,
I think they've got to carry it in.
You know how they could have a clean break that would actually make a lot of sense and I think could work really well?
She's death. Pregnant.
She's pregnant and dead.
No, yeah, have her die. Have the conflict between them the whole time, and then at the end, kind of have that, this is why our relationship is broken, have them both realize it, and then either, you know, make the decision to, you know, to fix it and then have her die, or have her say, man, we could have made this work, but one of us has to stay here and hold this button. Mm. And that would be a clean break, and that would wrap that story up so nicely.
It's the most depressing Christmas ever.
Hey, Merry she's already Christmas, died on Christmas everyone. Once. Why don't we kill her on Christmas again? It'll be a tradition.
Let's kill her every Christmas. It'll be great, guys.
Exactly.
See, I was... I was going to say, you know, we find out she's pregnant, which we kind of theorized about in our finale discussion. And then she's like, well, goodbye. I'm going to go live my happy little life. And then maybe like at the end of next season, we see him creeping through a window and see her with like a child or something.
Oh, and that so would you be get it. That tempers the right. sting.
Mm. Yeah, maybe. Well, we've got, what, 3 more weeks to figure it out?
Yep.
Oh, you know what would be great? If they did like a Ghost of Christmas past, present, and future thing, and we just saw her dying on a bunch of different Christmases.
Oh my God, you killed Clara!
That old chestnut.
Yeah. We thought we had lost Rory. He just regenerated into a female form.
Just once they should put her out there in the Centurion's costume. just once. You know, she's going to some masquerade party or something. And you she know, puts on just the helmet and looks to the doctor and says, what? What?
I wouldn't mind if it was just that Jenna Coleman went to a Halloween party dressed as a Centurion. That could work for me. All right. So next week, we're going to take a look back specifically at the 12th Doctor. And see, I mean, we looked at series 8 as a whole, but we want to take a look at Capaldi's first series as the Doctor and see, you know, where we came in with, you know, with Deep Breath and how he evolved over the series.
So. And we will also be explaining the Caecilius and Frobisher connections. So tune in for that one, because we're going to make it all make sense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. All right. Well, this has been episode 114 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, yeah, vanity is definitely my weakness.
And this is Gary saying, I could make the tea. Or isn't that American enough? I don't know. I could make grits. What are grits?
And this is Haley saying, that jackanapes, all he ever does is cause trouble.
We'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You can also go to GunnaGeek.com to check out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.